What's up, nerds? Welcome back to another episode of The Layman. I'm your host and layman, John Gabris. Today, I am talking to Rosalie Licardo-Pakula. She's a senior economist at RAND's Drug Policy Research Center. I know what you're saying to yourself right now. Sick, man. Drugs. And yeah, we get into it a little bit, but I think you're not going to be as pumped about what she has to say. I don't know exactly what RAND is, she'll tell us, but it's in a huge fortress in Santa Monica, and I got my car checked for bombs. And I didn't have any. Except for a DVD of Geely. Topical. Tell us a little bit about what it is that you do before I even try to succinctly explain it.
I'm a senior economist. I co-direct RAND's Drug Policy Research Center, and I also direct the Bing Center for Health Economics. So I do research on health economics and drug policy.
Oh, excellent. So what, and what is RAND besides
the
Iron Fist's company's name? Are you guys getting stepped on a lot by the new Netflix series, Iron Fist? His name is Danny Rand, and his dad owns Rand Enterprises or whatever.
You guys don't copied even know that one.
Yeah, a huge Marvel lawsuit.
Rand is actually a historical institution, came out of the Air Force in the 1960s. We were originally the think tank for the Air Force and slowly grew into other areas of defense and then into social policy issues. So we are a nonpartisan, nonprofit research organization whose mission is to provide information to better inform public policy.
Okay. So it's like for, you guys are a research think tank for the government.
Or not necessarily just the government. No, okay. We do research for the U.S. government. A lot of our defense research goes straight to the government, but we also do research for other international organizations, both private as well as governmental.
Oh, interesting. Now, is like the RAND think tank the people behind like ESP and the Pentagon's brain and stuff? Or can you not
speak?
We
contributed to the internet.
Oh,
building
okay.
The internet. We also contributed to the development of windsurfers.
Oh, that's awesome. I love that you're saying that, like, don't ask any follow-up questions. We can tell you nothing of that. That reminds me, randomly, I met an animal trainer on set in some sequence in which a wolf had to hump me, for lack of a better word. So a wolf had his paws up on my shoulders and was dry humping me. And I said to the guy, I'm like, oh, what part wolf is this dog? He's like, it's 100% wolf. What are you talking about? Oh. I was like, all of a sudden I got super scared. He's like, I've been training animals since I was 18. I used to train dolphins and seals for the Navy. I go, oh, what'd you do for them? He's like, can't tell you that. And I was like, oh,
and that
man.
Compares him to be a trainer for a wolf. How?
Yeah, I know. And that's what I was like, okay, sure. What's the logic in the middle here? Are all animals the same to train? I was terrified. That's one of my favorite things about science is like, oh, we're trying to do whatever. Like, I couldn't imagine RAND set out to be like, let's make windsurfing a sport. But they found like they were doing something else. So like, I can picture a scientist going like, I actually caught like a pretty groovy wave today. And they're like, hey, man, what if we did this recreationally? Meanwhile, the Air Force is like, where are you on our paraglider troops? You know, and you know, like everyone's just got like suntans and like...
What happens when you put a bunch of different great minds from different disciplines together? You get all kinds of creative ideas.
Oh, this is my dream job.
Yes, my dream, mine too.
Damn it. That's so awesome. I want to be invited to a room full of geniuses. I don't know why I would be there. Maybe I'll be serving snacks, but I want to be in a room full of geniuses and was like, we have some outside the box problems. Yes, we're all different scientists, but this guy is a comedian. So we need his friend.
Creativity.
Yeah.
We need the creativity.
I'm like, what if we? Everyone's like, shut this guy up. He doesn't even know what a non-polar.
So for the real science geek in you, we also did provide some consultation on the old Star Trek show, right? Gene Roddenberry's group.
Whoa. Oh, why
so we
that?
Have astrophysicists and all kinds of really cool, very intelligent people. And then there's people like me who snuck in the back door.
We have tons of great, smart people working here. You're just not interviewing one of them currently.
Correct. Correct.
Can we talk? Let's talk. Oh, man. I'm going to leave my resume at the door. Oh, this guy hasn't worked in an office or worn pants in a decade. I think he's prepared to work here.
That works.
So let's talk a little bit about what it is specifically you do here in that department, the economic health policy.
So there's,
I have it written down, but I refuse to look at it. So I'm going to keep getting it wrong.
No, there's so two primary research centers that I'm involved in, the Bing Center for Health Economics. So healthcare reform, a small topic.
Is that something that people have been talking about? I don't have time for the news.
Yeah. it's, you know, third or fourth order to, you know, marijuana policy or opioid epidemic.
That's what I'm here to talk about. I've completely lost healthcare coverage, but I have a couple of quick questions about weed.
That's okay. It wouldn't cover your weed anyway. So,
damn it. It's a pre-existing condition. My potheadness. And so then in that, what is the what are you studying
so,
there?
Everything. The Bing Center, all I do as director of the Bing Center is just coordinate the research that is being undertaken by a bunch of people here, doctors, nurses, lawyers, economists like myself, sociologists, psychology. We bring all that research, the research that's being conducted by our various teams, and make sure it gets disseminated to policymakers at the state, local, and international level. And we also facilitate discussions, because what happens in research universities at times is people tend to work in their department and talk to the people in their department and stay focused on ideas that are relevant in their department. A place like this tries to avoid that sort of compartmentalization and bring those people together and engage in conversations that they wouldn't otherwise engage in. And then you find out, we hadn't thought about approaching this problem that way, but that would totally apply. And do that.
That is so cool.
Within our center.
That is so good. So for that, it's all different scientists studying all different facets of that, but sharing their information with each other, which is an advantage that not a lot of places would have.
Which is particularly relevant in areas like drug policy, because drug policy is an area where the data and the information hasn't been as good, because alcohol and tobacco have been legal. We have pretty good data on that. But things like marijuana and the black market, cocaine, methamphetamine, opioids, most of the non-prescription opioids, not as good data.
Hallucinogenics, has some new research behind it.
So bringing
creativity.
You're
going to see that I have pretty much the science knowledge of your world based on like Vice documentaries. That's about the extent of my information. So I pre-apologize for how little I know.
That's perfectly fine. So we get to bring all that together and bring in the different disciplines. So one of the things that I, like you, get fascinated. I'm an economist by training. I have a PhD in economics. But I get really fascinated talking to our lawyers, understanding why. Why did the law pass this way? Why didn't it say X about the markets? Because I as an economist, think the law is only about the markets, right? No, laws get passed by people who have very different ideas of what constitutes a law.
Oh, yeah.
So having a better understanding of what emerged and what that means in a legal context helps me do a better job at my job of analyzing then the impact on the market.
What made you get into economics? When did you start finding that interesting? Did you ever?
I came from a family of lawyers.
Did
my
you?
My dad was a lawyer. I had three siblings who were lawyers. I spent my summers working in a law firm, and I didn't want to be a lawyer. We'd talked a lot of politics at home. I was always fascinated with politics and law. And in college, discovered economics was kind of behind a lot of both of those, the allocation of resources and who has ownership rights. So I kind of stumbled into it because I didn't want to be a lawyer.
Oh, interesting. But you were intrigued by that world a little bit, but you just didn't want to do it because
I don't think I understood it. I thought economists sit in banks. I thought that was the extent of economics.
Oh, okay. When I was younger, I was like, oh, an economist is someone who does your taxes. Like, they know so much about the economy that they do. And then I'm like, I learned, I'm like, oh, no, wait, that's way simpler than understanding fundamental currency. I was like, oh, okay, yeah, never mind. I was way off.
My dad loves to take bets with me on what's going to happen with the GDP next year, because he, the lawyer, consistently does better than me, the economist, predicting next year's GDP.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a really fun household. I can imagine a house full of lawyers. They're like, all right, I'll allow it, Rosalie. What drew you once you started studying economics? Because like being interested in is one thing. Getting a doctorate in it is an insane
amount
of work.
I was at a small liberal arts Jesuit university for college, Santa Clara University. Fabulous school.
I went to a Franciscan college those Catholic universities, they can do it all.
Well, and you're you are grilled into you that you must do something with a purpose to serve. I got to do a program in Washington, D.C., because as I said, I was always kind of interested in politics. I was a double major, actually, political science and economics, and went to D.C. on this economic policy program to find out what is it. And I saw there were economists at the Treasury, there were economists at the Feds, there were economists in the White House and the Council of Economic Advisors, there were economists all over Washington, D.C. And that kind of really made me realize that I can do policy and not be involved in politics and just have those discussions of good policy with the principles of economics.
Working in politics without being a politician seems like the way to do it, right? Like,
it's the only way to do it.
I couldn't imagine like having to be a politician, but I would love, obviously, it's such a strong calling to want to work in that field to like...
You have to avoid the politics at all costs.
Right.
But that's the other reason why I like working here in particular. RAND is not affiliated with any political party at all. It's very, very clear on our nonpartisanship. And if we touch a partisan issue, we always make sure the team has members from different political beliefs so that what we agree on is the science. In a place like this, we can have honest, fun, collaborative discussions of the policy that are completely independent of the political position.
Right. Because for some reason in the last few years, it feels like science has become a partisan issue.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Which is like terrifying. And I just think it's like loudest kid in the room sort of situation where I would imagine there are some scientists who hold some conservative beliefs and also can wrap their heads around the potential dangers of global warming. Like, I feel like you can both... Thoughts can exist.
Well, and I always have to laugh because they always think, oh, higher education, they're all liberals. There's not a whole lot of liberal economists.
No, no, because
there are a few. There are a few.
Right. But, you have, but if you're money oriented,
the principles of the market are pretty clear.
Yes. There is. Yeah. If you are using economics as one factor to make decisions, liberal, you're not thinking about necessarily the things that liberals would be thinking about. Now I'm out of my water completely. I don't know anything about politics or science. Stay tuned to my other podcast where I just go on Fox and Friends and I'm just outclassed. I don't know, even by those guys. Here, you end up in these the Bank Center and the drug policy
research center.
That has some key words that draws my attention, and mainly you say drugs and specifically marijuana policy.
That's one of the policies we've been spending a lot of time with.
Very zeitgeist right now.
15 years we've been doing research on marijuana policy.
Me too. Oh, you said policy at the end?
Policy, not behavior.
I've been doing some self-experimentation for a better part of a decade.
You're not alone.
Turns out I'm not, based on you've probably done some research that a lot of people are into it. Can you talk a little bit about the kind of stuff that, because to me, all you see is like, based on the information I hear, and obviously there's a confirmation bias to what I want to hear. I want to hear federal legalization, right? Then you hear like Colorado raised X amount of dollars for schools. And it's like, oh, that's the blanket correct answer. Like, guys, let's do it. The people want it and it's helping the government or economy or whatever you want to say. It just seems like at that point, people who believe that you should be able to do whatever you want in life or whatever.
Libertarians
be like, oh, yeah. You should be able to smoke weed if you want to smoke weed. And then the people who are against it should see the financial possibilities and then say, okay, fine. It should be okay.
And I think you've just basically expressed what is going on in most of the country. The reason why we continue to study it is that like many things that are new products, we don't know what the real implications of them are. That doesn't mean we should be believing it's all bad. How many 14-year-olds ever died from smoking a cigarette?
None,
unless they lit a fire the lighter, right?
Yeah.
The fact that somebody can die from something in 25 years is something that we consider with tobacco.
Right.
We haven't been studying marijuana that long to know that. That doesn't mean that it's harmful. I'm not saying definitively we have an answer.
But you can't, as a scientist, also say definitively it's an objective, fine, smoke away. You know,
as an objective scientist, and forget about the smoking. And that's what's so interesting about marijuana policy to me. So people are saying, oh, so just don't smoke it. Put in a vape pen. That's better for you. Or put it in an edible. Then you're not smoking. And for medical purposes, a lot of the doctors feel much better about prescribing an edible or an oil than something's combustible, right?
Yeah.
The problem is, again, we are just learning about marijuana in the body. And what's really fascinating to me is how quickly this science is beginning to evolve. Unlike other substances, which just operate in one part of our brain, the pleasure center of the brain that everyone refers to, we have a naturally occurring endocannabinoid system that goes all over our brain, not just in the pleasure center. It goes in our frontal cortex and it affects all different parts of our brain, as well as natural receptors all throughout our body. That's part of the reason why there are therapeutic benefits of certain cannabinoids in the cannabis plant, because our body has these receptors everywhere and they can help a certain organ functionality or pain. But that's also why we need to study what the long-term consequences are, like any drug,
right?
Whether we're taking a prescription or otherwise. And we don't have that science. And more importantly, what science we have is based on marijuana that could be procured from the NIH, which is at like 5 to 7% THC, the psychoactive ingredient.
Meanwhile, the Jack Herer I just bought is like 31%.
Yeah. And what we're seeing with commercialization of marijuana is an increase in the THC potency. Again, we know that makes people higher. Okay, is that bad yet? Well, it does increase the amount of impairment. And for people who have different dispositions, they could have a bad episode for their own because of some other underlying condition that they had. We don't know what the long-term effect is of a higher exposure. And the way I like to communicate this is think about a diabetic who's eating sugar. Yeah. You have to learn to regulate sugar because as somebody who develops type 2 diabetes, they ate too much sugar and then their body didn't know how to handle it or process it correctly themselves.
Right.
I believe we're going to see something similar with cannabis, but I don't know what the health condition or health problem could be just because we have it all over our body. So that means there's probably legitimate things that it can really be healthy for. But you're talking about 80 different cannabinoids. And right now our market, our medical and legal market are gearing up on just a couple of those cannabinoids. That's not how it naturally grew in the plant.
Right.
So what is that going to mean to our bodies? And it's going to take time to answer that question. It's going to be 20 years before we'll know.
I know. And but how long have opioids been studied?
A lot longer. Oh, yes. Yeah. We had the first heroin epidemic back in the 1970s.
So. Right. And like these new pills that are coming out all the, like that's to me, it's a classic like stoner argument. It's like, we're ready to prescribe pills, but we can't let anyone smoke a plant or whatever, you know what I mean? That's what we hear all the time.
Well, and that's exactly why in the case of opioids, they were proposing giving them for chronic pain for people who were terminally ill. They're going to die. Give them opioids, please. That didn't automatically mean that it was good for acute pain.
Right.
And by overprescribing for acute pain, we actually created some of the opioid epidemic by causing people to get addicted because they had an acute pain problem.
Yeah. On an anecdotal level, that's like, I'm from Long Island, New York, and everyone there, but like opioids got so huge, even as like recreational or people getting addicted to it and then unable to afford it or harder to get prescriptions. Then they started doing heroin and it's like, Jesus.
Because heroin came in cheap right after that. It was good marketing.
It's just like the thing your doctor said you're allowed to have, but cheaper.
And unfortunately, we can improve regulation of the prescription opioids.
Right.
It's much harder to figure out how to regulate in the black market.
Yeah, yes. Exactly.
Which is why it's an interesting and complex problem.
Here's another thing you hear in this stonery world. It's like big alcohol is refusing to let cannabis take off recreationally because they believe it'll step on the business of selling beer.
Yeah, I think alcohol. It's really funny that people are already drawing conclusions on that because the research is completely mixed. I can tell you I have studies that show both. And I don't believe either any of them yet, because the reason why is the way we're doing research is with available data. So we asked people, in the last 30 days, did you use marijuana? And in the last 30 days, did you use alcohol? If they said yes to both, then they're complements. If they said yes to one and no to the other, then they're substitutes.
Yeah.
Okay, I buy gas and I buy milk in the same 30-day period. That doesn't mean they're related at all.
It doesn't mean
you
can run your car on milk.
Right. So our questions are starting to evolve and improve information. Okay, are you using them together at the same time? But those are small samples and we only have a little bit of data, and we're trying to see how that plays out. And we also need to know, why were they used together? I mean, you can buy cannabis as tinctures with alcohol, right?
Yeah, right.
So I think we don't know what the relationship is. It's one of the big question marks about if we legalize cannabis, even if there's long-term health conditions and health problems associated with it, if you stop people from drinking alcohol, which has acute death as well as long-term death, there could be overall as a society a net benefit. And some people have made that case. We don't know the answer to that question yet, and it's going to take a lot more time. So right now, those are advocacy arguments.
Yes.
And I can't say yes or no to them, because it might be true. It might not be true.
We're waiting for results.
I need the data.
What are the big questions, the big dominoes that need to fall or to be answered in marijuana policy to start? There's a lot, I'm assuming. Yeah. What are some of the big ones, or at least the umbrella ones that... You guys are looking into now.
So there's a whole bunch of, and it's really, I actually am very lucky. I get to sit on an NIH, National Institute of Health work group, where we're trying to help the National Institute of Drug Abuse come up with their research agenda for marijuana policy, so we can help get better science to improve policy. People think, oh, doesn't that just mean prohibition? No. I mean, and NIDA is actually funding a lot of the therapeutic research on marijuana as well. So they genuinely care about the science of the drug. One of the things we don't know at all, so we can tell if somebody has used marijuana, and they might even tell us the number of times they used in the past 30 days. Okay, so I drank alcohol the last 5 days of the week. Do you know if I'm an alcoholic or not?
No, because I would need to see at least 360 more to determine.
Well, even off of a week, you'd want to know how much alcohol when you were drinking.
Right.
Right?
And or you were on vacation in Cancun. It's like, okay, that's...
Circumstances, yeah. Was it Christmas last week or graduation week? Right. Those sort of things can matter. But mostly you want to know, when I was drinking, was I having one glass of wine, or was I having four beers or seven beers, right?
Right.
Or was I having several mixed drinks? You need that sort of amount per episode to have a context of whether or not someone's using something. More importantly, with alcohol, if someone said, I had 5 glasses of wine, that's different than 5 shots of vodka.
Right.
We don't ask any of those questions related to cannabis. We don't know if they're smoking the 5% THC or the 25%, or if they're doing oil, which is 70% THC.
Right.
We don't know how much. So we don't...
Yeah, you don't know if they're smoking a gram or an eighth, or... And then, I mean, I love the idea of that. You have scientists who have to go so far and be like, now are you just taking little baby hits, or are you holding that shit in, brother? It's like, what is this question on?
Well, I think it's funny. Whenever I do research with my colleagues in Australia, they crack me up, because, you know, we say binge drinking 5 or more drinks for men here. They're like, that's just getting started in Australia.
Yeah.
But when it comes to marijuana, they'll pass around a joint and everyone shares a joint. Not in the U.S. That's not as common. So there's also cultural patterns things that we need to think about. So we're trying to get... But so important for marijuana policy, understanding how is it being used, not just with alcohol or without alcohol, in lieu of alcohol or in lieu of opioids, or but also how much, how frequent. When do people get up and need a hit when they get on with the day? Or do they wait till the end of the day and do it in the privacy of their home at the end of the day? The potential consequences, if you think from a public health perspective, are different depending on these questions of use. But because of the prohibition, most of our questions have just been about, do you use or not use?
Right.
How many times? So we have a lot to move forward to better understand the use behavior and what's being consumed. Legalization will help us with that. That's a good thing.
There'll be more research subjects.
We also know a lot more about the products. Any new market. When you get the new phone, iPhone, you want to know about all the features, right? And whatever they hype you on, you're like, oh, I really want to have that feature. We have a little of that going on with cannabis. You go into a pot shop and you're overwhelmed with the varieties of different things. And what's the really cool thing? You ask the sellers, what do I want to buy? Because the consumer doesn't have that much information yet, right?
Right, right.
And so there's a little bit of pushing into certain higher potency THC products or certain oils or dabs and things that are new and innovative. But we don't know if these are going to stick or not because we don't know if the consumer is going to go, yeah, I really like that. Or, oh God, that was not
I do
a good
feel
experience.
Like every week I go into the dispensary and there's like a new thing that, this is a keef laced joint. It's going to be, it's the next one is like, it's a palm leaf blunt. Oh, you got to use this inhaler that is a THC. Oh, this CBD oil. And I'm like, I still like the thing I first tried, you know, the joint.
Yep.
Yeah. Anytime an older relative visits me in LA that I know imbibes and is like, hey, are we gonna? And I'm like, we're gonna, but I just need to give you a heads up. This isn't some fucking Maui Wowie from a friend from the Bronx. This is like scientists made this to get you as high as like,
it's just really, as a it's heads becoming up. Quite a science. Yeah. And
it's
so
like if you used to just sip red wine with your friends and now you're going to funnel Fireball like that, right. Like you got to let's keep that in mind.
Here. And actually, some of the owners of the medical cannabis shops are very concerned about that because right. They're really afraid that abuse and misuse of this bleeding into the legal and let's go explore everything will make people believe that marijuana doesn't have any positive health effects. This is all just a marketing scheme. And so they're working really hard to try to figure out one of the reasons why the science has been slow in identifying the positive health effects or the negative health effects. It's not just what I was telling you about, you know, how much are you using amount? What's a dose? You know, when you're taking aspirin, how many you're supposed to take based off your body and your weight, right? That's the really difficult question when you're doing something for medical research. We need to know what a dose is.
Interesting, yeah.
And the medical community and medical marijuana is working really hard at ways of coming up with a single medical dose of either oil in a vape pen or something like that.
It's beginning to seem like 10 milligrams is a dose.
That's but then it's sort like, of by it's artifact.
Low. Yeah.
That's by artifact.
Yeah.
It's on like, the edibles.
Right. On the edibles. Because it's like 10 milligrams doesn't get me to feel anything.
No.
I mean, maybe some background stimulation or whatever, but I'll need 30 to feel the
just
effects.
Like yeah. Somebody who's been drinking alcohol regularly isn't going to be significantly impaired with one beer.
Alcohol we know is bad in the long is bad to continue to use over.
We've had decades of research to show that.
Right, right.
We don't
and
have
it's still legal.
And we don't have to. There are a good share of individuals who just don't use because it is illegal, or maybe they'll try, but they will never take on a regular pattern of use if it's illegal. I have a federal security clearance. I don't get to keep that if I do something illegal.
Right.
There's things in our system that deter people from doing things that are illegal. So while some might not be deterred by that, and that's understandable, you can't say because something is legal and allowed, our military is allowed to drink. Does that mean there's no drinking problem in the military?
Right.
No.
Right.
So there's a lot more alcohol because it's allowed.
Yeah.
And illicit drug use is near zero in an area where there's really strict enforcement because it is monitored. So the fact that, you know, some people have chosen to use is fine.
Yeah.
If you've told me you've used for 20 years, that still doesn't tell me what the long-term effects are today's cannabis are going to be. It tells me the low THC didn't do much.
Right, right.
Okay, that's
and I
useful.
I only need to smoke one garbage ditch weed joint to tell you that the low THC doesn't do much.
So?
I guess what I was getting at is that, just because the research hasn't been completed on marijuana yet doesn't mean it will be, well, even if research comes out, it's like, hey, 25 years of heavy smoking is going to have some negative effects. That's why we can't allow smoking to be legal. That's like, that's not necessarily going to happen either.
No.
Because there is long-term negative effects of eating meat, of smoking cigarettes and drinking beer, which are all legal. That's not necessarily going to stop the legalization of marijuana.
So I think what the issue typically has been related to whether or not something should be legal or illegal relates to two things. One, to what extent does a person have control over their use, right? And for the vast majority of people who drink alcohol, they don't have an alcohol problem, the vast majority.
Right.
That's different than heroin.
Yes. Right. There are a few people who are like, I just have one, rip a horse after work and I...
Or a methamphetamine, yeah, yeah. Right? So I think that's part of the concern. And in the case of cannabis, while the low-dose marijuana was not highly addictive, we don't know yet about the high THC content.
Oh man, imagine if at the end of this interview, I like quit weed. I'm too scared. And my whole life turns around and I'm like, Rosalie, I just become an economist. I saw the light.
I'm just trying to help people make informed decisions. I drink Diet Coke. Right. I don't want to know what's in that Diet Coke because I don't want to have to give it up.
Right.
But it's the same thing. Yes, that's a legal product. And it might be that causes more cancer than cannabis does.
Yeah.
Who has the research on the Diet Coke?
I wonder.
There's a few articles out there.
There are. I wonder if there's any big corporations that would try to squash any negative research.
That's a big question. So the thing with marijuana policy and the difficult position that someone like me is in is the science is nowhere near ready to inform and provide objective policy. My colleague Bo Kilmer and I both co-direct the center, have been in conversations with Canada as they're going through their legalization process, and we get constant inquiries. Okay, so if we decide that we want to regulate THC, what's a good level?
We have no, no one knows.
We have no idea.
Wait, this is a think tank I could maybe be part of. I hate to keep pushing for me to just get a job by the end of this, but I'm just saying you need one person in the room who's just like, oh, is the guy, the 300-pound 30-year-old in cutoff shorts and a Hawaiian shirt? What's his? You'll see his expertise.
You'll see a few people looking like you around the building. Don't be surprised. It's one of these areas is really difficult because the policy is moving much quicker. Mm-hmm. And so the good news is, okay, we'll get some data and we'll be able to determine that. But still, like the scientific health effects, we have to have a standardized dose to evaluate that. We can't get that going into pot shops in Washington or in Colorado. There's no standardized dose. So people are saying, well, why don't we just go and use the weed that's available? Well, tell me what a standard dose is. People don't know what a drinker knows what a standardized dose is.
Yeah.
A cigarette smoker knows what a standardized dose is.
Right.
A pot user doesn't.
And then even a pot user is like, oh yeah, so it's 1 gram of dried cannabis flower. It's like, oh, okay, is it a hybrid, a sativa, an indica?
Exactly.
You're like, oh fuck, I didn't even think of that. Back to the drawing board, guys.
Exactly.
Is there any research that you guys are either doing or seeing or that's bringing back results that are pointing in a certain direction? I mean, I this is so...
And we do no provocative research at all.
No provocative research. Is there anything like in the marijuana research where it's like, oh, we realize in places where marijuana is legal, less DWIs or less opioid use.
Mortality. Yeah. So what I love, if someone were to blog my name, they would see lots of how I am, anti-legalization. I have one of the first studies that showed that states with medical marijuana dispensaries that legally protect them so that there's more commercialization of the medical marijuana and more access, lower opioid-related mortality. Now, what we don't know, and that's out there, right? It's research.
Causation or correlation?
Well, no, it's... The techniques that we have are, I think, pretty convincing that it's causal. And there's other studies that have been done as well that show a decline. I mean, if you interview people in drug treatment facilities, they'll tell you that they've switched to cannabis, some of them from opioids. That's legitimate in pain clinics. There's two studies that were done by David Bradford and Ashley Bradford that looked at Medicaid and Medicare population and saw people in states with medical marijuana dispensaries had lower prescriptions of opioids in those two states. There's a lot of evidence suggesting that's the case. Now, the question is this. Are these are legitimate patients switching to marijuana instead of opioids? And some of them probably are. Or were they people that were gaming the system? We knew they were pharmacy shopping and doctor shopping to get cheap opioids. And now they don't have to because there's a medical marijuana shot.
All right.
Now,
did they need the opioids in the first place?
Was it a true medical need or not?
Yeah,
So some people say, well, it doesn't matter. If it's saving lives, why do we care? Okay. Clearly, marijuana is not killing people when they're using it. But we need to know the mechanism before we advocate for a policy, because well, one, I'm not supposed to advocate for any policy. I'm just supposed to show the science. We don't know the mechanism. And there's at least three that have very different implications for policy. One of them is that maybe it's not opioids that are being abused by the patients who are getting the marijuana. Maybe it's benzos that are being reduced, their use of benzos, rather than opioids for some of the patients. And marijuana and opioids won't kill you the way benzos and opioids will kill you. And so there's a substitution. Okay, why is that? You're still saving a life, but the problem is you still have an addict. A drug policy that promotes addiction is probably not a good policy.
Yeah, you don't maybe want to a substitute better, addiction.
Maybe a better policy is to promote treatment.
Right.
If you're looking at society's resources. If it isn't, if these are truly even patients that are being switching, okay, that tells us something too. And again, I think that we need more information on mechanisms before we can say this is a really good policy.
That makes complete sense. Obviously, it's scientific. Of course, it makes sense. I just want to back it up to, like, you talked about substitution. Oh, that's not necessarily a good thing, is to give up opioids but be addicted to marijuana. Because I know anecdotally, recovering alcoholic friends who no longer drink, but now smoke marijuana as their vice. And it's like, are you stealing for Peter to pay Paul? Or is it, hey, he's not drinking and driving, or his addiction to alcohol is different, or is he addictive personality? And now it's just going to be this and Diet Coke for.
I have learned over time, my opinion of that has changed. And I think it's because that's not a scientific question. Absolutely. It's also kind of your own social moray.
Right.
If you talk about being addicted to opioids versus being addicted to marijuana, yes, marijuana is addictive, but it won't shut down your liver and it won't cause you to go into respiratory shock. And so from a health care perspective, it's safer to be addicted to marijuana than it, as far as we know right now. Mm-hmm. We could learn something entirely new in 20 years that I don't know about the plant, based on our knowledge today, than say opioids. And in fact, when you think about substitution therapy like buprenorphine or methadone,
right,
you're switching somebody from a highly addictive something to something that's less addictive, and they're still fully functioning. So the question really is the person switching to marijuana functioning in their daily life, or are they sitting on the couch unable to move?
Right.
That, I think, is what you want to better understand in terms of making that question. There's some people have a strong opinion addiction to anything is bad. Okay, well, I'm addicted to gum and Diet Coke, so I'm in that camp. I'm bad.
I know no one ever says someone who's like, she does so much yoga, she's an addict. That's bad.
Actually, that's how I started my dissertation, was exercise addiction.
Oh, that's interesting. But yeah, no one, that's just as bad if you're truly addicted to it, but no one's going to fault you for that. Research being done, or has there been research done, if marijuana truly is a gateway drug?
Oh yeah, they've been doing work on that for a long time.
Yeah, and is it where are the results falling on?
All over the place.
All over the place.
Yeah, no, I think part of the reason why is obviously as we learn more about the brain, we're going to learn a lot more about how things affect the brain. And I think if you take a neuroscience perspective, there's a reason to believe that there are connection and positive reinforcement. If you hit a certain pleasure area and it keeps reinforcing, and this does the same thing, that's going to be reinforcing.
Harder. Yeah.
If you know somebody who can get you pot, they probably can get you something else too. And so then there's a personal market perspective. So when you say, does marijuana use cause other things? What are you saying? Are you saying, is there a neurological response? Are you saying that it's a friendship response? Or is it a true, you know, I turn the switch and the light comes on. That's a direct. In fact, one of my colleagues here did a cool study that showed that one of the reasons why the gateway effect has held such a strong, what's the word? It's stayed with us for so long is because it's been replicated in other societies, not just in the US. And a colleague of mine, Andrew Morrell, did a study shortly after I got here because he knew I was the gateway person. And he's like, hey, let's look at this. Showed that it could be done off complete random data too. So then there's this question of, okay, really, is there a causal mechanism if it can also happen randomly? So some of this question is, okay, we need to learn more. We need to know the mechanisms. And I think with the Brain Initiative, we'll learn a lot more about that mechanism. We still have the market social mechanism, which is outside of the brain. And the question is, will we ever be able to disentangle the person from their environment and from their brain? Probably not. So I don't know that we'll know beyond steps.
Oh, man, that's what I love about one of the underrated things about science is that it answers one question, which gives you 100 more.
Right.
And that's just so like, but the fact that it could be systematically solved too is what, because then you could answer those 100 questions, which gives you exponential another 1,000 questions.
Now, the problem is the scientists love all those questions, right? We get excited when we found the 5 more. The politician says, but I want to know yes or no.
Yeah. I need to know right now what I need to tell my constituents and also the people that are funding me to stay here. I need something that threads the needle both ways. So.
And sometimes with enough science, we can give them an honest yes or no.
This has been an amazing conversation. Now I'm going to ask you some of the more one-off, non-businessy okay. type of questions I just love to ask scientists. What are you guys do for fun, either specifically economists or researchers here? Like, is there something that's like, often I hear it's trivia night is like catnip to scientists and stuff like that. But do you have anything in particular? You're like, we just rip bong hits. You're like immediately, like immediately undo everything you said. It's like, oh yeah, we just smoke all this marijuana we get.
No, we have to have federal government clearances.
Oh, right. Wait, shit, I can't work here.
So I have to answer that not as me, because I'm a mom that I have 2 teenagers that I'm running all over Timbuktu. So that's what I get to do with all my free time when I'm not working in my phase of life.
Oh, and you mentioned that a lot of people leave here on Fridays at lunchtime to go play beach volleyball.
Well, I don't know if it's Fridays. I'm not part of that club, but yes, there's a regular beach volleyball group.
I'm dying to get invited.
So I think it's just like any other place. There, play hard and work hard.
Yeah.
Work hard.
Oh, work hard. Sorry. I'm like, play hard and party hard. Got it. You're like, John, you forgot work. Wait. I'm like, I know. Rosalie, thank you so much for taking the time out of it. That's the hardest part of hosting this podcast is that over the course of the interview, you learn how important that person's job is. And then you realize how much your time being wasted is exponentially worse than my time being wasted. Right now, Congress is like, where's the research on drugs? Like, she's apparently talking to some schmuck about me.
Well, because some of those laws get informed by people's knowledge and opinion, and you need whatever communication information can get to them.
Awesome. And then here's our last final, this is the last question we talk to everyone about on The Layman. What would you say to someone, a young person who was potentially thinking of working or studying in the STEM field? Like, I have an issue with, and I was the pioneer of that generation of like, I'm just gonna be famous and charming and magnificent. And now everyone wants to be a basketball player, an Instagram model, or a professional skateboarder. Nobody, less so do you hear people wanting to be accountants, lawyers, and biochemists and stuff. But if a young person was thinking about potentially studying STEM in some capacity, would you have any advice or any, or if someone was like, I don't know if I should do that. I want to be blank. Like what could you tell someone like that?
I'll tell them what I tell my daughter. Absolutely. And if you're thinking psychology, do psychiatry, do it with more, you know, my thinking is that our society is continuing to evolve. The jobs that aren't disappearing and aren't becoming automated right away are the jobs that involve STEM. That's not to say none of those are being automated, but there's more innovation, more need for creative thinking, and computers aren't doing creative thinking yet. So I think that moving towards STEM is vitally important, but showing kids that it can be fun. I mean, the whole idea of the robotics clubs, I think is totally cool because it shows them hands-on what you can do.
That's what I think too. And I feel like if I have, this is something I could actually help with. I would love to be like, speak to high school freshmen or like, let's talk about the cool stuff that scientists get to do. Because I feel like you sit in math class or in science class and you assume that science extrapolated out is that.
No.
You're like, oh, it's just a lot of people droning on and on about. It's like, no, it's about answering questions that you personally have.
And we need to get them interested in doing more than just cooking up new drugs.
Right, right. Well, yeah, the golden handcuffs of science where you're like, well, it's...
Or the profit. I mean, it's profitable for kids, right?
Right, yeah.
No, I think there's other... I think that science is critically important for us as a society and also for any individual who wants to get a job 15 years down the road.
Right.
Not everybody's going to be the famous actor or basketball player, right. But... we are certainly going to need more computer programmers who can figure out how to program your airplane to land on time.
Worst comes to worst, you could always interview scientists for a living. I feel like it's a very small niche, but I found it. Thank you, Rosalie, for taking time out of your busy and important schedule to waste an hour and change with yours truly. Guys, she had a lot of important stuff to say, and it really made me think. I'm going to head home, smoke a joint, and think about it. I might start studying the long-term effects of weed on a person. I mean, I'm 10 years into the study, so let's figure it out. Guys, this is the last episode of The Layman for now, so if you want to hear more episodes, you know, tweet about it, get pumped. If you are a scientist and you want to be on The Layman, get at me. We'll figure out something, and hopefully we'll do more of these. And if you're the parent of a child, I'm assuming if you're a parent, you have a child. You know, it makes sense. Why don't you gently nudge them in the direction of science or technology or engineering or mathematics? Something that could help this country. We have enough YouTube stars and we certainly have enough barely knowledgeable podcast hosts, okay? So no more. I mostly just don't want anyone to steal jobs from me in the future. So why don't you all go into science and build bridges and cure cancer and give little hamsters back legs? The Layman is a Stitcher original and a production of Midroll Media. My EPs are Chris Bannon and Jenny Radlett. My producer is the wonderful Rob Perra. And I am your layman, John Gabris.